Man yelped in pain. "Shut the fuck up!" Tommy Guns yelled. The second man learned from his friend's example. He took the harsh tape removal process without making a sound. Bam Bam threw the gag to the side of the room and then moved behind the men. He grabbed the nexus of the rope that tied the arms and legs together and knocked each man onto his side so I could see his face better.
"Please don't kill us,"
one of the men said, desperation tightening his voice.
"It wasn't personal. We were paid to do a job. We could have killed you, but we didn't."
I suddenly recognized him as the one who did all the talking in the garage. "It's them," I said, pointing down. "He did the talking, and he did the punching. Who are they?" Sisko nodded, as though the confirmation was only a formality. "They're brothers. The talker is Joey Mack. The puncher is, get this, Angel Mack."
"Listen, we don't even know what it was about,"
the talker yelled out.
"Please, we made a mistake. We..."
"You're fucking A-right you made a mistake,"
Sisko yelled, his voice coming down on both of them like the wrath of God.
"And now you pay! Who wants to go first?"
The puncher started to whimper. Sisko walked over to a card table where there was a spread of tools and weapons, plus the roll of tape. He chose a pipe wrench and a set of pliers and turned back. I thought and hoped it was all an act. But if it was, Sisko was turning in an Oscar-caliber performance. I put my hand on his shoulder and held him from approaching the two men. I didn't have to say anything, but the message was clear. Let me have a shot at them. I took the wrench from Sisko and squatted like a baseball catcher in front of the captives. I hefted the heavy tool in my hand for a few seconds, getting a good feel for its weight, before speaking. "Who hired you to hurt me?" The talker answered immediately. He wasn't interested in protecting anybody but himself and his brother.
"A guy named Dahl. He told us to hit you hard but not kill you. You can't do this, man."
"I think we can do whatever we want. How do you know Dahl?"
"We don't, but we had a mutual connection."
"And who is that?" No answer. I didn't have to wait long before Bam Bam lived up to his moniker and leaned down and hit them both with piston-like punches to the jaw. The talker was spitting blood when he gave me the name.
"Jerry Castile."
"And who's Jerry Castile?"
"Look, you can't tell anybody this."
"You're not in a position to tell me what I can or can't do. Who's Jerry Castile?"
"He's the West Coast representative."
I waited, but that was it. "I don't have all night, man. West Coast representative of what?" The bloodied man nodded, like he knew there was only one way to go here.
"Of a certain East Coast organization. You get it?"
I looked at Sisko. Herb Dahl had ties to East Coast organized crime? It seemed far-fetched. "No, you don't get it," I said. "I'm a lawyer. I want a direct answer. Which organization? You have exactly 5 seconds until..."
"He works for Joey Giordano out of Brooklyn, okay? Now you've sealed the deal on us anyway, so go fuck yourself."
He reared back and spit blood at me. I had left my suit coat and tie at the office. I looked down at my white shirt and saw a bloodstain just outside the area that would be covered by a tie.
"This is a monogrammed shirt, you shithead."
Tommy Gunn suddenly moved between us, and I heard the brutal impact of fist on face, but didn't see it because of Tommy's massive size. He then stepped back, and I could see the talker was now spitting out teeth.
"Monogrammed shirt, man,"
Tommy Gunn said, as if offering an explanation for his vicious action. I stood up. "Okay, cut them loose," I said. Sisko and the two saints turned to look at me. "Cut 'em loose," I said again.
"You sure?"
Sisko said.
"They'll probably go running back to this fucker Castile and tell him we know."
I looked down at the two men on the floor and shook my head. "No, they won't. They tell him that they talked and they'll probably end up dead. So cut them loose and it's like this never happened. They'll drop out of sight until the bruises go away, and that will be the end of it."
I bent down to get close to the two captives. I have that right. Right?
Yeah, said the talker, a bulge the size of a marble forming on his upper lip. I looked at his brother. Is that right? I want to hear it from both of you.
Yeah, right,
the puncher said. I looked at Sisko. We were finished here. He gave the order.
Okay, guns, listen up. You wait till dark. You leave them in here and wait till dark. Then you bag them and take them back to wherever they want to go. You drop them off, but you leave them alone. You got it?
Yeah, I got it.
Poor Tommy Guns. He truly looked disappointed. I took one last look at the bloodied man on the floor, and they looked up at me. The feeling of holding their lives in my hands sent an electric jolt through me. Sisko tapped me on the back, and I followed him from the room, closing the door behind me. We started down the hall, but I put my hand on my investigator's arm and stopped him.
You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have brought me here.
Are you kidding? I had to bring you here.
What are you talking about? Why?
Because they did something to you. Inside. You lost something, Mick, and if you don't get it back, you aren't going to be much good to yourself or anybody else.
I stared at him for a long moment, and then nodded.
I got it back.
Good.
Now we never have to talk about this again.
Can you take me back to the office so I can pick up my bike?
Yeah, I can do that.
Chapter 31. Driving by myself after dropping Sisko in the garage, I thought about the law of the land and the law of the streets and the differences between them. I stood in courtrooms and insisted that the law of the land be applied fairly and appropriately. There was nothing that had been fair and appropriate about what I had just been party to in the black room. Still, it didn't bother me. Sisko had been right. I needed to gain the upper hand inside my own soul before I could gain it in court or anywhere else. I felt renewed as I drove. I opened all the Lincoln's windows and let the evening air course through the car as I came down Laurel Canyon toward home. This time, Maggie had used her key. She was already inside when I got there, an unexpected but pleasant surprise. The refrigerator door was open and she was leaning down and looking in.
I really came because you always used to stock up before a trial. Your refrigerator was like going down the cold aisle at Gelson's. But what happened? There's nothing here.
I dropped my keys on the table. She had been to her own home from work first and had changed. She wore faded denim jeans, a peasant shirt, and sandals with thick cork heels. She knew I liked that outfit. I guess I didn't get around to it this time.
Well, I wish I'd known. Might have considered going somewhere else on my one night this week with a sitter.
She smiled slyly. I couldn't figure out why we weren't still living together.
How about we go down to Dan's?
Dan Tana's? I thought you went there only when you won a case. You already counting your chickens, Holler?
I smiled and shook my head.
No, no way. But if I went there only when I won, then I'd hardly ever get to eat there.
She pointed a finger at me and smiled. It was a dance, and we were both well used to it. She closed the fridge and walked through the kitchen door, and then right past me without so much as a kiss.
Dan Tanis is open late, she said.
I watched her walk down the hallway toward the master bedroom. She pulled the peasant blouse up over her head just as she disappeared into the room. We didn't really make love. Something about what I had seen and felt in the black room at the Saints was still with me. Call it residual aggression, or the release of the impotent anger I had felt. Whatever it was, it informed all my moves with her. I pulled and pushed too hard. I bit her lip and held her wrists together above her head. I controlled her, and I knew what it was all about while I did it. Maggie went with it at first. The newness of it was probably interesting, but curiosity eventually turned to concern, and she turned her face from mine and struggled to free her hands. I held her wrists tighter. Finally, I saw tears well in her eyes.
What?
I whispered into her ear, my nose pressing hard into her hair.
Just finish, she said.
All aggression and drive and desire went down the psychic drain after that. Her tears and telling me to finish made me unable to. I pulled out and off, rolling to the side of the bed. I put a forearm across my eyes, but still could feel her watching me.
What?
What is it with you tonight? Is this something to do with Andrea? Getting me back for what's going on in court or something? I felt her move off the bed.
Maggie, of course not. Court's got nothing to do with it.
Then what? But the bathroom door had closed before I could answer, and the shower immediately was turned on, cutting off the exchange.
I'll tell you at dinner, I said, even though I knew she couldn't hear me.
Dantana's was packed, but Christian came through and got us quickly into a booth in the left corner. Maggie and I had not spoken during the 15-minute ride into West Hollywood. I had tried some small talk about our daughter, but Maggie had been unresponsive, so I let it go. I thought that I would try again in the restaurant. We both ordered the steak Helen with pasta on the side, Alfredo for Maggie, and Bolognese for me. Maggie picked an Italian red for herself, and I ordered a bottle of fizzy water. After the waiter left, I reached across the table and put my hand on her wrist, gently this time.
I'm sorry, Maggie. Let's start over.
She pulled her arm away from me.
You still owe me an explanation, Holler. That wasn't making love. I don't know what's going on with you. I don't think you should treat anyone that way, but especially not me.
Maggie, I think you're overdoing it a bit. For a while there you liked it, and you know it.
And then you started to hurt me.
I'm sorry. I never want to hurt you.
And don't try to act like it was a passing thing. If you ever want to be with me again, you'd better start telling me what is happening with you.
I shook my head and looked out at the crowded room. The Lakers were on the overhead TV in the bar that divided the place. People were crowded three deep behind the lucky patrons who had the stools. The waiter brought our drinks, and that bought me some more time. But as soon as he left the table, Maggie was on me.
Talk to me, Michael, or I'm taking my dinner to go. I'll take a cab.
I took a long drink of water and then looked at her.
It has nothing to do with court or Andrea Freeman or anybody or anything else you know, okay?
No, not okay. Talk to me. I put my glass down and folded my arms on the table.
Cisco found the two guys who attacked me.
Where? Who are they?
That doesn't matter. He didn't call the police. He didn't turn them in.
You mean he just let them go?
I laughed and shook my head. No, he held them. Him and two of his associates from the Saints. For me. In this place they have. To do what I wanted. Whatever I wanted. He said I needed it.
She reached across the checked tablecloth and put her hand on my forearm.
Holler, what did you do?
I held her eyes for a moment.
Nothing. I questioned them and then told Cisco to let them go. I know who hired them.
Who?
I'm not going to get into that. It's not important. But you know what, Maggie? When I was in the hospital waiting to find out if they were going to be able to save my twisted nut, all I could think about were these violent images of me getting those two guys back. I mean, Hieronymus Bosch torture stuff. Medieval shit. I wanted to hurt them so bad. Then I get my chance, and believe me, these guys would have just disappeared after.
And I let it go.
And then I'm with you, and...
She leaned back in the booth. She stared off into space, a mixture of sadness and resignation on her face.
Pretty fucked up, huh?
I wish you hadn't told me all of that.
You mean as a prosecutor?
There's that.
Well, you kept asking.
I guess I should have made up a story about being mad at Andrea Freeman. That would have been okay with you, right? If it was about men and women, you could understand that.
She looked back at me.
Don't patronize me.
Sorry.
We sat in silence and watched the activities in the bar. People drinking, being happy. At least outwardly. The waiters in tuxedos moving about and squeezing between the crowded tables. When our food came, I was no longer particularly hungry, even though the best steak in town was on the plate in front of me.
"Can I ask you one final thing about it?"
Maggie asked.
I shrugged. I didn't see the point in talking about it anymore, but relented.
"Ask away."
"How do you know for sure that Sisko and his associates let those two men go?"
I cut into my steak, and blood oozed onto the plate. It was undercooked. I looked up at Maggie. "I guess I don't know for sure." I went back to my steak, and in my peripheral vision, I saw Maggie wave down the busboy.
"I'm going to take this to go and try to grab a cab out front. Can you bring it out to me?"
"Of course, right away."
He hustled off with the plate.
"Maggie," I said, "I just need some time to think about all of this."
She slid out of the booth.
"I can drive you."
"No, I'll be fine."
She stood next to the table, opening her purse.
"Don't worry about it, I've got it."
"You sure?"
"If there's no cab out there, look down the street at the Palm. There might be one there."
"Okay, thanks."
She left then, to wait for her food outside. I pushed my plate a few inches back, and contemplated the half-full glass of wine she left behind. 5 minutes later, I was still considering it, when Maggie suddenly appeared, the to-go bag in her hand.
"They had to call a cab," she said.
"It should be here any minute." She picked up her glass and sipped from it.
"Let's talk after your trial," she said.
"Okay." She put the glass down, leaned over, and kissed me on the cheek. Then she left. I sat there for a while, thinking about things. I thought maybe that last kiss had saved my life. Chapter 32. This time in his chambers, Judge Perry sat down. It was 9:05 Wednesday morning, and I was there along with Andrea Freeman and the court reporter. Before resuming trial, the judge had agreed with Freeman's request for one more conference out of the public eye. Perry waited for us to settle in our seats, then checked that his reporter's fingers were poised over the keys of her steno machine.
"Okay, we're on the record here in California versus Trammell," he said. "Ms. Freeman, you called for an in-camera conference. I hope you're not going to tell me you need more time to pursue the issue involving the federal target letter."
Freeman moved to the front edge of her seat.
"Not at all, Your Honor. There is nothing worth pursuing. The issue has been thoroughly vetted, but full knowledge of what is going on with the federal agencies involved does not comfort me. I believe it is clear from what I know now that Mr. Holler is going to attempt to push this trial off the rails with issues that are clearly irrelevant to the matter before the jury."
I cleared my throat, but the judge stepped in first.
"We handled the issue of third-party guilt in pre-trial, Ms. Freeman. I am allowing the defense the leeway to pursue it to a point. But you have to give me something here. Just because you don't want Mr. Holler to pursue this target letter doesn't make it irrelevant."
"I understand that, Judge, but what—"
"Excuse me," I said. "Do I get a turn here? I'd like the chance to respond to the insinuation that I'm pushing—"
"Let Ms. Freeman finish, and then you'll get a good long tug, Mr. Holler. I promise you that. Ms. Freeman?"
"Thank you, Your Honor. What I'm trying to say is that a federal target letter essentially means almost nothing. It is a notice of a pending investigation. It is not a charge. It's not even an allegation. It doesn't mean that they have found something or will find something. It is simply a tool used by the feds to say, 'Hey, we heard something and we're going to look into it.' But in Mr. Holler's hands in front of the jury, he's going to spin this into the harbinger of doom and attach it to someone not even on trial here. Lisa Trammell is the one on trial, and this whole thing about federal target letters is not even remotely relevant to the material issues. I would ask that you disallow Mr. Holler from making any further inquiry of Detective Curlin in this regard."
The judge was leaning back with his hands in front of his chest, the fingers of each hand pressed against each other. He swiveled to face me. Finally, my cue.
"Judge, if I were in Your Honor's position, I think that I would ask counsel
since she says she thoroughly vetted this letter and its origin. If there is a sitting federal grand jury looking into foreclosure fraud in Southern California. And then I would ask how she has concluded that a federal target letter amounts to almost nothing. Because I don't think the court is getting a very accurate assessment of what the letter means or what its impact is on this case. The judge swiveled back to Freeman and broke one of his fingers free to point in her direction.
What about that, Ms. Freeman? Is there a grand jury?
Judge, you are putting me in an awkward position here. Grand juries work in secret and...
We're all friends here, Ms. Freeman, the judge said sternly. Is there a grand jury?
She hesitated and then nodded. There is a grand jury, Your Honor, but it has not heard any testimony in regard to Louis Aparicio. As I said, the target letter is nothing more than a notice of a pending investigation. It's hearsay, Judge. And it doesn't fit into any exception that would speak to its admissibility in this trial. Though the letter was signed by the U.S. attorney for this district, it was actually authored by a Secret Service agent handling the inquiry. I have the agent waiting downstairs in my office. If the court wishes, I can have him in chambers in 10 minutes to tell you exactly what I just did. That this is a lot of smoke and mirrors on Mr. Haller's part. At the time of Mr. Bondurant's death, there was no active investigation yet, and no connection between the two. There was just the letter.
That was a mistake. By revealing that Vasquez, the Secret Service agent who penned the target letter, was in the building, Freeman had put the judge into a difficult position. That the agent was nearby and easily accessible would make it harder for the judge to dismiss the issue out of hand. I stepped in before the judge could respond.
Judge Perry, I would suggest that since counsel says she has the federal agent who wrote the letter right here in the courthouse, she simply put him on the stand to counter anything that I might draw from Detective Curlin on cross-examination. If Ms. Freeman is so sure the agent will say the target letter he wrote amounts to nothing, then let him tell the jury that. Let him blow me out of the water. I remind the court that we've already dipped our toes into these waters. I asked Curlin about the letter yesterday. To simply go back out there and not mention it again, or have you tell the jurors to unring the bell and dismiss it from memory? That could be more damaging to our collective cause than a full airing of this issue. Perry answered without hesitation.
I tend to think that you are correct about this, Mr. Haller. I don't like the idea of leaving the jury all night with this mysterious target letter to ponder, and then pulling the rug out from under them this morning.
Your Honor, Freeman said quickly, may I be heard once more?
No, I don't think that is necessary. We need to stop wasting time in here and get the trial started.
But, Your Honor, there is one other exigent issue the court has not even considered.
The judge looked frustrated.
And what is that, Ms. Freeman? My patience is drawing thin.
Allowing testimony about a target letter directed at the defense's key witness will likely complicate that witness's previous decision not to invoke his Fifth Amendment rights during testimony in this case. Louis Aparicio and his legal counsel may well reconsider that decision once this target letter is introduced and discussed publicly. Therefore, Mr. Haller may be building a defense case that ultimately results in his key witness and straw man, if you will, refusing to testify.
I want it on record now that if Mr. Haller plays this game, he must abide by the consequences. When Aparicio decides next week that it's in his best interest not to testify and asks for a new hearing on the subpoena, I don't want defense counsel crying to the court for a do-over.
No do-overs, Judge.
The judge nodded, agreeing with her.
I guess that would be tantamount to the man who killed his parents asking the court to show mercy on him because he's an orphan. I'm in agreement, Mr. Haller. You are on notice that if you play it this way, you must be prepared to shoulder the consequences.
I understand, Judge, I said, and I will make sure my client does as well. I only have one point of argument, and that is counsel's labeling of Louis Aparicio as a straw man. He's no straw man, and we'll prove it.
Well, the judge said, at least you'll get a chance to.
Now, time is wasting. Let's get back into the courtroom.
I followed Freeman out, leaving the judge behind while he put on his robe. I expected her to hit me with a verbal assault, but I got the opposite.
Well played, counselor, she said. Thanks, I think.
Who do you think sent the letter?
I wish I knew.
Have the feds contacted you? My guess is they're going to want to find out who's leaking sensitive and confidential documents to the public.
Nobody said Jack yet. Maybe it was the feds who leaked it. If I get Aparicio on the stand, he's stuck with his testimony. Maybe I'm just an instrument of the federal government here. Ever think of that?
The suggestion seemed to put a pause in her step. As I passed her, I smiled. As we entered the courtroom, I saw Herb Dahl in the front row of the gallery behind the defense table. I suppressed the urge to pull him over the rail and pound his face into the stone floor. Freeman and I took our positions at our respective tables, and in a whisper, I filled my client in on what had happened in chambers. The judge entered and brought the jury in. The last piece of the picture was filled in when Detective Curlin returned to the witness stand. I grabbed my files and legal pad and went back to the lectern. It seemed like a week since my cross-examination had been interrupted, but it had been less than a day. I acted as though it had been less than a minute. Now, Detective Curlin, when we left off yesterday, I had just asked you if you knew what a federal target letter is. Can you answer that question now?
My understanding is that when a federal agency is interested in gathering information from an individual or company, they sometimes send out a letter that tells that individual or company that they want to talk. It's sort of a letter that says, come on in and let's talk about this so there's no misunderstanding.
And that's it?
I'm not a federal agent.
Well, do you think it's a serious matter to receive a letter from the federal government telling you that you are the target of an investigation?
It could be, I guess. I would assume that it depends on the crime they're looking into.
I asked the judge for permission to approach the witness with a document. Freeman objected for the record, citing relevance. The judge overruled without comment and told me I could give the document to the witness. After handing the document to Curlin, I returned to the lectern and asked the judge to mark the document as Defense Exhibit 3. I then told Curlin to read the letter.
Dear Mr. Aparicio, this letter is to inform...
Wait, I interrupted. Could you first read and describe what is at the top of the letterhead?
It says, Office of the United States Attorney, Los Angeles, and it's got a picture of an eagle on one side and the U.S. flag on the other. Should I read the letter part now?
Yes, please do.
Dear Mr. Aparicio, this letter is to inform you that A. Lewis Aparicio Financial Services, Incorporated, known as Aloft, and you individually are among the targets of a multi-agency task force investigating all levels of mortgage fraud in Southern California. Receipt of this letter puts you on notice not to remove or destroy any documents or work materials related to the business of your company. Should you wish to discuss this investigation and cooperate with members of the task force, please do not hesitate to call or have your legal counsel make contact with me or Charles Vasquez of the U.S. Secret Service, who has been assigned to the Aloft investigation as case agent. We will make every effort to meet with you to discuss this matter. If you do not wish to cooperate, you can be assured that you will be contacted shortly by agents of the task force. I once again have to remind you not to destroy or remove any documents or work product from your offices or associated premises. To do so after receiving this notice would be to commit a serious crime against the United States of America. Sincerely, Reginald Lattimore, U.S. Attorney, Los Angeles. That's it. Except it gives everybody's phone numbers at the bottom.
A low murmur went through the courtroom. I was sure most of the general citizenry was unaware of things like federal target letters. It was law enforcement in the new era. I was sure the so-called task force amounted to token contributions of agents from a handful of agencies on no budget. Instead of mounting expensive investigations, it would take a shot at scaring people into coming in and begging for mercy. A design to pick the low-hanging fruit, grab a few headlines, and call it a day. Someone like Aparicio probably used the original letter received via certified mail as toilet paper. But that didn't matter to me. My plan was to use the letter to help keep my client out of prison.
Thank you, Detective Curlin. Now, can you tell us, is the letter dated?
Curlin checked the copy before answering.
It's dated January 18th of this year.
Now, Detective, had you seen that letter before yesterday?
No. Why should I have seen it? It's got nothing to do with...
Move to strike is unresponsive, I said quickly.
Your Honor, the question was simply whether he had seen the letter before.
The judge instructed Curlin to answer only the question asked.
I had not seen this letter before yesterday.
Thank you, Detective. And now let's go back to the other letter I asked you to read yesterday, from the victim, Mitchell Bondurant, to the same Louis Aparicio, who is addressed in the federal target letter. Do you have that handy there in your binder?
If I could have a moment.
Please.
Curlin found the letter in the binder, removed it, and held it up.
Good. Can you tell us the date of that letter, please?
January 10th, this year.
And that letter was delivered to Mr. Aparicio by certified mail, correct?
It was sent certified. I cannot tell you if Mr. Aparicio received it or ever saw it. It has someone else's name listed as signing for it.
But no matter who signed for it, it is a certainty that it was sent on January 10th, correct?
I think that's correct.
And the second letter we've talked about here, the target letter from the Secret Service agent, was sent by certified mail as well, am I right?
That's right.
So the date of January 18th is certified as to when it was mailed?
Correct.
So let me see if I have this right. Mr. Bondurant sends Louis Aparicio a certified letter that threatens to expose alleged fraudulent practices in his company. And then, 8 days later, a federal task force sends Mr. Aparicio another certified letter, this one saying he is the target of an investigation into foreclosure fraud. Do I have this timeline right, Detective Curlin?
As far as I know, yes.
And then less than 2 weeks later, Mr. Bondurant is brutally murdered in the garage at Westland, right?
That's right.
I paused and rubbed my chin like a deep thinker. I really wanted to hold the jury with this. I wanted to look at their faces but knew it would reveal my play, so I went with a deep thinker pose. Detective, you have testified about your wealth of experience as a homicide detective, correct?
I have a lot of experience, yes.
Hypothetically speaking, do you wish you knew then what you know now?
Curlin squinted, like he was confused,
even though he knew exactly what I was doing and where I was going.
I'm not sure I understand, he said.
Put it this way. Would it have been good for you to have those letters in hand on the first day of the murder investigation?
Sure, why not? I'd take all evidence and information on the first day any time, but that never happens.
Hypothetically speaking, if you knew that your victim, Mitchell Bondurant, had sent a letter threatening to expose another man's criminal behavior, just 8 days before that man learned he was the target of a criminal investigation, wouldn't that be a significant avenue of investigation for you?
It is hard to say.
Now I looked at the jury. Curlin was waffling, refusing to acknowledge what common sense dictated he should own up to. You didn't need to be a detective to understand that.
Hard to say.
Are you saying that if you had this information and these letters on the day of the murder, it would be hard to say if you would follow up on them as a significant lead?
I'm saying that we don't have all the details, so it is hard to say how significant it was or wasn't. But as a general answer, all leads are followed up. It's as simple as that.
As simple as that. Yet you never pursued this angle of investigation, did you?
I didn't have this letter. How could I have followed it up?
You had the victim's letter, and you did nothing with it, didn't you?
Not true at all. I checked it out and determined it had nothing to do with the murder.
But isn't it true that by that time you already had your supposed murderer, and you weren't going to let anything change your mind or make you deviate from that path?
No, not true. Not true at all.
I stared at Curlin for a long time, hoping that my face showed my disgust.
No further questions at this time, I finally said. Chapter 33. Freeman kept Curlin on the stand for another 15 minutes of redirect, and did her best to re-sculpt his account of the investigation into a sterling effort of crime-fighting. When she was through, I passed on another crack at him, because I was convinced that I was already ahead on Curlin. My effort had been to sell the investigation as an exercise in tunnel vision, and I believed I had succeeded. Freeman apparently felt that the need to address the federal target letter was urgent. Her next witness was the Secret Service agent Charles Vasquez. He had not even been known to her 24 hours earlier, but now had been interjected into her carefully orchestrated lineup of witnesses and evidence. I could have objected to his testimony, on the grounds that I had not had the opportunity to question or prepare for Vasquez, but I thought that would be pushing it with Judge Perry. I decided to at least see what the agent had to say on direct before I'd go that far. Vasquez was about 40, with a dark complexion and hair to match. During the preliminaries, he said he had formerly been a DEA agent before shifting to the Secret Service. He went from chasing drug dealers to chasing counterfeiters, until the opportunity came to join the foreclosure task force. He said the task force had a supervisor and 10 agents coming from the Secret Service, FBI, the Postal Service, and the IRS. An assistant U.S. attorney oversaw their work, but the agents, assigned to pairs, largely worked autonomously, with freedom to pursue targets of their choice. Agent Vasquez, on January 18th of this year, you authored a so-called target letter to a man named Louis Aparicio, and it was signed by U.S. Attorney Reginald Lattimore. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
Before we get into that specific letter, can you tell the jury exactly what a target letter is?
It's a tool we use to smoke out suspects and offenders.
How so?
We basically inform them that we are looking into their affairs, their business practices, and actions they have taken. A target letter always invites the recipient to come in to discuss the situation with the agents. A high percentage of the time, the recipients do just that. Sometimes it leads to cases. Sometimes it leads to other investigations. It's become a useful tool because investigations cost a lot. We don't have the budget. If a letter can result in charges being filed, or a witness cooperating, or a solid investigative lead, then it's a good deal for us.
So in regard to the letter to Louis Aparicio, what made you send him a target letter?
Well, my partner and I were very familiar with his name, because it came up often in other cases we were working. Not necessarily in a bad way, just that Aparicio's company is what we call a foreclosure mill. It handles all the paperwork and filing on foreclosures for many of the banks operating in Southern California. Thousands of cases. So we kept seeing the company, aloft, and sometimes there were complaints about the methods the company was using. My partner and I decided to take a closer look. We sent out the letter to see what sort of response we'd get.
Does that mean you were fishing for a reaction?
It was more than fishing. As I said, there was quite a lot of smoke from this place. We were looking for fire, and sometimes the reaction we get from a target letter dictates what our next moves are.
At the time you authored and sent the target letter, had you gathered any evidence of criminal wrongdoing on the part of Louis Aparicio or his company?
Not at that point, no.
What happened after you sent the letter?
Nothing so far.
Has Louis Aparicio responded to the letter?
We got a response from an attorney saying that Mr. Aparicio welcomed the investigation because it would give him the opportunity to show he ran a clean business.
Have you availed yourself of that welcome and investigated Mr. Aparicio or his company further?
No, there hasn't been time. We have several other ongoing investigations that appear to be more fruitful.
Freeman checked her notes before finishing. Finally, Agent Vasquez, is Louis Aparicio or Aloft currently under investigation by your task force?
Technically, no, but we plan to follow up on the letter.
So the answer is no.
Correct.
Thank you, Agent Vasquez. Freeman sat down. She was beaming,
and obviously pleased with the testimony she had drawn from the agent. I stood up and took my legal pad back to the lectern. I had written down a few questions off the direct examination. Agent Vasquez, are you telling the jury that an individual who does not respond to your target letter by immediately coming in and confessing must be innocent of any wrongdoing? No, I'm not. Because Louis Aparicio did not do so, do you consider him to be in the clear now? No, I don't. Do you make it a practice to send target letters to individuals you believe are innocent of any criminal activity? No, I don't. Then what is the threshold, Agent Vasquez? What does one need to do to receive a target letter? Basically, if you come across my radar in any sort of suspicious way, then I'll do some preliminary checking and that may lead to the letter. We're not sending these out scattershot. We know what we're doing. Did you or your partner or anyone from the task force speak with Mitchell Bondurant in regard to the practices of Aloft? No, we didn't. Nobody did. Would he have been someone you would have talked to? Freeman objected, calling the question vague. The judge sustained the objection. I decided to leave the question floating out there unanswered in front of the jury. Thank you, Agent Vasquez. Freeman went back to her scheduled rollout of the case after Vasquez, calling the gardener who found the hammer in the bushes of the home, a block and a half from the scene of the murder. His testimony was quick and uneventful, by itself unimportant, until it would be tied in later with testimony from the state's forensic witnesses. I did score a minor point by getting the gardener to acknowledge that he had worked in and around the bushes at least 12 different times before he found the hammer. It was a little seed to plant for the jury, the idea that maybe the hammer itself had been planted long after the murder. After the gardener, the prosecution followed with a few quick hits of testimony from the homeowner and the cops who carried the chain of custody of the hammer to the forensic lab. I didn't even bother with cross-examination. I was not going to contest chain of custody or the fact that the hammer was the murder weapon. My plan was to agree not only that it was the weapon that killed Mitchell Bondurant, but also that it belonged to Lisa Trammell. It would be an unexpected move, but the only one that worked with the defense theory of a setup. The lead through Jeff Trammell that the hammer might be in the back of the BMW he'd left behind when he disappeared to Mexico didn't pan out. Sisko was able to locate that car, still in use at the dealership where Jeff Trammell had worked, but there was no hammer in the trunk, and the man in charge of fleet management said there never was. I dismissed Jeff Trammell's story as an effort to get paid off for information that might be helpful to his estranged wife's case. The murder weapon sequence brought us to lunch, and the judge, as was beginning to be his custom, broke 15 minutes early. I turned to my client and invited her to go to lunch with me. "What about Herb?" she said. "I promised him I would go to lunch with him." "Herb can come too." "Really?" "Sure, why not?" "Because I thought you didn't..." "Never mind, I'll tell him." "Good, I'll drive." I had Rojas pick us up and we went down Van Nuys to the hamlet near Ventura. The place had been there for decades, and while it had classed itself up since the days it was called Hamburger Hamlet, the food was just the same. Because the judge had gotten us out early, we avoided the noon lineup and were immediately shown to a booth. "I love this place," Dahl said, "but I haven't been here in ages." I sat across from Dahl and my client. I didn't respond to his enthusiasm for the restaurant. I was too busy working out how I was going to play the lunch. We ordered quickly, because even with the early start, our time window was small. Our conversation was focused on the case and how Lisa perceived things to be going. She was pleased so far. "You get something that helps me from every witness," she said. "It's quite remarkable." "But the question is, do I get enough?" I responded. "And what you have to remember is that the mountain gets steeper with each witness. Do you know Bolero? It's classical music. I think it was composed by Ravel." I got two blank stares back. "It's okay. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's a long piece. Maybe 15 minutes or so. And it starts off slow, with just a few quiet instruments,
and then it gathers momentum and builds into a crescendo. A big finish, with all the instruments in the orchestra coming in together. And that's what the prosecutor is doing here. She's building sound and momentum. Her best stuff is still to come, because she's going to bring everything together with drums and strings and horns by the time she's finished. You understand, Lisa? She nodded reluctantly. I'm not trying to knock you down. You're excited and hopeful and righteous, and I want you to stay that way. Because the jury picks up on it, and it helps just as much as anything I do in there. But you have to remember, the mountain is getting steeper. She's got the science still to come, and juries love science, because it gives them a way out, a way of deferring. People think they want to be on jury duty. You get out of work, you sit front row on an interesting case, real-life drama in front of you instead of on the tube at home. But eventually, they have to go back into that room and look at each other and decide. They have to decide somebody's life. Believe me, not too many people want to do that. The science makes it easier. Oh, well, if the DNA matches, then it can't be wrong. Guilty as charged. You see, this is what we still face, Lisa, and I don't want there to be any illusions about it. Dahl gallantly put his hand on her arm, which leaned on the table. He gave it a comforting squeeze.
Well, what will we do about their DNA? Trammell asked.
Nothing, I said. There's nothing I can do. I told you before trial we had our own people test it and we got the same answers. It's legit. Her eyes were cast down in defeat, and I saw the start of tears, which was what I wanted. The waitress chose that moment to show up with our lunch plates. I waited until we were left alone before continuing. Cheer up, Lisa. The DNA is just window dressing. She looked up at me in confusion.
I thought you just said it's legit.
It is, but that doesn't mean there isn't an explanation for it. I'll handle the DNA. Like you said when we sat down, my job here is to drop a doubt into each piece of their puzzle. Then, we hope when all their pieces are in place and they hold the picture up to the jury, that all the little seeds of doubt we have sown have grown into something that changes that picture. If we do that, then we get tan.
What's that mean?
We go home, we go to the beach, and we get tan. I smiled at her, and she smiled back. Her tearing up had smeared the intricate makeup work she had performed that morning. The rest of lunch was punctuated by small talk and uninformed or inane observations of the criminal justice system by my client and her paramour. This was a common thing I had observed in my clients. They don't know the law, but are quick to tell me what is wrong with it. I waited until Trammell forked the last bite of salad into her mouth. Lisa, your mascara got a little smeared during the first part of our conversation. It's very important that you stay strong and look strong. I want you to go into the restroom and make yourself look strong, okay?
Can I just do it at the courthouse?
No, because we might be going in at the same time as some of the jurors or the reporters. You never know who will see you. I don't want anyone thinking you're spending your lunch hour crying, okay? I want you to do it now, and I'll call Rojas to come pick us up.
It might take me a few minutes.
I check my watch. Okay, take your time. I'll wait a little bit on Rojas. Dahl got up so she could slide out of the booth. Then we were left alone. I had pushed my plate to the side and had my elbows on the table. I had my hands clasped together in front of my mouth, like a poker player holding up his cards to help hide his face. At heart, a good lawyer was a negotiator. And now, it was time to negotiate Herb Dahl's exit. So, Herb, it's time for you to go. He gave me a small smile of misunderstanding.
What do you mean? We all came together.
No, I mean from the case. From Lisa. It's time for you to disappear. He kept the I don't understand demeanor going.
I'm not going anywhere. Lisa and me, we're close. And I have a lot of money tied up in this thing.
Well, your money's gone. And as far as Lisa goes, that's a charade that is coming to an end right now. I reached into the inside pocket of my coat and pulled out the photo of Herb with the brothers Mac that Sisko had given me the night before.
I handed it across the table to him. He gave it a quick look, and then laughed uneasily.
Okay, I'll bite. Who are they?
The Mack brothers. The men you hired to work me over. He shook his head, and glanced over his shoulder at the rear hallway that led to the restrooms. He then turned back to me.
Sorry, Mickey, but I don't know what you're talking about. I think you have to remember here that you and I have a deal on the movie. A deal involving circumstances I'm sure the California Bar would be interested in reviewing. But other than that...
Are you threatening me, Dahl? Because if you are, you're making a mistake.
No, no threat. I'm just trying to figure out where you're coming from.
I'm coming from a dark room, where I had an interesting conversation with the Mack brothers.
Dahl refolded the photo and handed it back to me.
These two? They were asking me for directions, that's all.
Directions, huh? Are you sure it wasn't money they were asking for? Because we have photos of that, too.
I might have given them a few bucks. They asked for help and seemed nice enough.
Now I had to smile. You know, you're good, Herb, but I got their story. So let's just skip all the bullshit and get down to the play.
He shrugged.
Okay, this is your show. What's the play?
The play is what I said at the top. You're gone, Herb. You kiss Lisa goodbye. You kiss the movie deal goodbye. You kiss your money goodbye.
That's a lot of kissing. What do I get for all that?
You get to stay out of prison. That's what you get.
He shook his head and glanced over his shoulder again.
Doesn't work that way, Mick. You see, that wasn't my money. It didn't come from me.
Who'd it come from? Jerry Castile?
His eyes made a quick movement and then settled. The name had hit him like an invisible punch. He now knew that the Mack brothers had caved and talked.
Yeah, I know about Jerry, and I know about Joey in New York, too. No honor among thugs, Herb. The Mack brothers are ready to start singing like Sonny and Cher. And the song is, I've Got You, Babe. I've got you all wrapped up in a nice little package, and unless you slink on out of Lisa's life and my life right today, I'm going to drop it off at the DA's office, where I happen to have an ex-wife who's a prosecutor, and who was very distressed by that attack on me. I figure she'll sail this one through the grand jury in a single morning, and you, asshole, will go down for aggravated assault with GBH. That means with great bodily harm. It's called a charging enhancement. It will get you an extra 3 years on the sentence. And as the victim, I'm going to insist on that. That's for my twisted nut. I'd say that all told with game time, you're looking at 4 years inside, Herb. And there's one thing you should know. They don't let you wear no fucking peace sign in Soledad.
Dahl put his elbows on the table and leaned forward. For the first time, I could see desperation enter his eyes.
You don't know what the fuck you're doing. You don't know who you're dealing with.
Listen, asshole. Can I call you asshole? I don't give a rat's ass who I'm dealing with. I'm looking at you, and I want you away from me and this case, and...
No, you don't get it. I can help you.
You think you know what's going on in this case? You don't know shit.
But I can school you, Holler. I can help you reach the beach, and we can all get tan.
I leaned back away from him, my arm up on the booth's padded backrest. Now I was puzzled. I flicked a wrist like this was a complete waste of time.
So school me. You think I just showed up on her picket line and said, let's make a movie? You dumb fuck. I was sent there. Before Bondurant was even put down, I was getting close to Lisa. You think that was happenstance?
Sent by who?
Who do you think?
I stared at him and felt the coalescing of all aspects of the case, like streams to the river. The hypothesis of innocence was not a hypothesis. The setup was real.
Aparizio.
He made one slight nod in confirmation, and at that moment I saw Lisa come through the back hallway, heading toward us,
her eyes shiny and bright again for court. I looked back at Dahl. I wanted to ask many questions, but we were out of time. 7 o'clock tonight, be at my office, alone. You tell me about Aparicio then. You tell me about everything, or I go to the DA. The one thing is, I'll never testify to anything. Never. 7 o'clock. I'm supposed to have dinner with Lisa. Yeah, well, change of plans. Think of something. You just be there. Now let's go. I started to slide out of the booth as Lisa arrived. I pulled my phone and called Rojas. We're ready, I said. Pick us up out front. Chapter 34. After court reconvened, the prosecution called Detective Cynthia Longstreth to the witness stand. By going with Curlin's partner as her next witness, Freeman was confirming what had been my growing assumption that her version of Bolero climaxed with the science. It was the smart play. Go with what can't be questioned or denied. Lay out the investigation through Curlin and Longstreth, and then bring it all together with the forensics. She would finish out the case with the medical examiner and the DNA evidence. A nice, tight package. Detective Longstreth did not look as tough and as severe as she did the first day of the case, when I had met her at Van Nuys Division. First of all, she was wearing a dress that made her look more like a schoolteacher than a detective. I had seen this sort of transformation before, and it always bothered me. Whether it was at the instruction of the prosecutor, or by the detective's own wiles, many a time I had been faced with a female police witness who had transformed herself to be softer and more pleasing to the jury. But if I dared point this out to the judge, or anybody for that matter, I ran the risk of being slapped down as a misogynist. So most times, I just had to grin and eat it. Freeman was using Longstreth to outline the second half of the investigation. Her testimony would be primarily about the search of the Trammell House and its findings. I was expecting no surprises here. After Freeman got her witness's bona fides on the record, she went right to it. Did you obtain a search warrant from a judge granting you access to Lisa Trammell's home? Freeman asked.
Yes, I did.
What is that process? How do you get a judge to issue such an order?
You make a request that contains a probable cause statement, which lists the facts and evidence that have led you to the point of needing to search the premises. I did that here, using the statement of the witness who saw the suspect in the vicinity of the bank, as well as the suspect's own inconsistent statements during the interview. The warrant was signed and issued by Judge Compagnoni, and we proceeded to the house in Woodland Hills.
Who is we, Detective?
My partner, Detective Curlin, and I. And we decided to bring a videographer and a crime scene team with us to process anything we might find during the search.
So the whole search was put on video?
Well, I would not say it was the whole search. My partner and I split up to make things move faster. But there was only one cameraman, and he couldn't be with both of us at once. The way we worked it was that when we found something that looked like evidence, or something we wanted to take into custody for examination, we would call for the camera.
I see. And did you bring the video with you today?
I did, and it has been placed in the player and is ready to go.
Perfect. The jury was then treated to a 90-minute video, accompanied by Longstreth's narration. The camera followed the police team as they arrived at the house and made a complete circuit around it before entering. While the view was in the backyard, Longstreth made sure to point out to jurors an herb garden, stepped with railroad ties and freshly turned soil. It was what the great filmmakers would call foreshadowing. Its meaning would become apparent later, once the camera was inside the garage. I was having trouble concentrating on the testimony. Dahl had dropped a bomb when he revealed the connection to Aparicio. I kept thinking about the possible scenario and what it could mean to the case. I wanted court to be over and for it to be 7 o'clock. On the video, a key taken from Lisa Trammell's belongings following her arrest was used to gain entrance to the house without damaging the property. Once inside, the team began a systematic search of the premises that seemed to follow a protocol born of experience. The shower and bathtub drains were examined for blood evidence, the washer and dryer as well. The longest part of the search took place in the closets,
where every shoe and piece of clothing was carefully examined and subjected to chemical and lighting treatments designed to draw attention to blood evidence. The camera eventually followed Longstreth as she left a side door to the house and crossed